Well, I'm joined from 2 Lord North Street by my good friend Martin Aguerup, a Danish economist, and my opposite number, really, at CEPOS, a free market think tank in Denmark. Martin, welcome to the Institute of Economic Affairs. It's fantastic to host you here. Tell us a little bit to begin with about what brings you here today, and tell us a little bit about CEPOS, the think tank that you head up in Denmark.
Well, Mark, actually, I'm here because your think tank is doing great work, and I'm here to speak to some of your employees about how they do it and get some inspiration. That's part of it. Another part of it is that you have some interesting events that I'm attending. And thirdly, to see you.
Well, that's obviously the third reason is always the best. So for our listeners, Martin's the author of several books. He's a regular columnist for the Danish daily broadsheet newspaper. I'm not going to be able to pronounce this right. Jyllands-Posten?
Yeah.
Did I pronounce that
correct?
That
was the paper that originally published the cartoons.
Is that right?
The Prophet Muhammad,
okay.
Yeah.
So you definitely have a controversial platform there.
Well, that's years ago.
Well, I'm glad that they're still giving airtime to controversial analysts. Now, there's a whole range of things I want to speak to you about, Martin. You've recently had a general election in Denmark. We'll come on to that in a little bit. But I want you to help our listeners here paint a bit of a picture of Denmark, because I think probably from the UK perspective, although the IEA's done a lot, I hope, to correct this, the impression is Denmark and Scandinavia in general is very highly regulated, high tax, high spend economy, and yet you're all rich and happy, and isn't the model that the UK, the USA, and all other sensible Western countries to follow, to go down the Danish model, higher taxes, higher regulation, and a bigger role for the state. Now, I know there's a bit of a myth there, but perhaps you could actually sort of paint the picture for English listeners about how free or socialist is Denmark as a country?
In many ways, a very free country. We've always had a liberal tradition in the broadest terms of what that word means. So we were the first country in the world to legalize pornography, for instance. I don't, we just mentioned the cartoons. I don't think it's necessarily a complete coincidence that that incident happened in Denmark, mm-hmm. because we are very, we believe very strongly in free speech and in the necessity of having people sometimes say things that others disagree strongly with, or even feel is hurting their feelings, so that we can have a debate about issues and get to know what is up and down, and you know how people feel about things, and increase knowledge.
But you've got that kind of classical liberal Enlightenment background. Tell us a little bit about the economic side,
yes.
of Denmark.
Yes.
That's often what the debate focuses on here. I think most folk here would think of Denmark as being a very liberal society in that regard, with regard to freedom of speech and expression. But what about tax, spending, the supposed social democratic approach of Denmark and other Scandinavian economies in terms of the role of the state?
Well, the people saying, look at Denmark, they have high taxes and they're wealthy. That's a bit like, to use a metaphor, you see someone at your local coffee shop eating a piece of chocolate cake every day, and the person is very fit looking. And you say, well, he's probably fit because he's eating chocolate cake. Well, that's not very likely to be the case. So if you study the person carefully, you might find that he or she does a lot of exercise, or only has that one piece of chocolate cake and that's all he eats all day, you know, something like that. And it's a bit the same with the high taxes. It comes with other things that compensate for the high taxes. So if you do a lot of exercise, you can actually eat some chocolate cake without getting fat. And if you do a lot of reasonable things, like having a small open economy, like having a flexible labor market, like having decent monetary policies, and we have low inflation and all that. So there are lots of very sensible things that we do with the Danish economy. Also reforming the welfare state. We have a pension system that's, that there is a public pension, but most people rely more on their private individual accounts. So mm-hmm. money they've paid into their account is their money. There's no transfer involved at all. And we also have a pension system that's fully funded. There's no future liability that's not funded. And we have public finances that are sound because of that. And that's been achieved through having the private pensions, but also through having retirement reform, resulting in people retiring much later now than they did just a few years ago, and into the future, retiring ever later as longevity increases.
Okay, you're doing a great picture of being an ambassador for your country and painting this rosy view, and it's important that we hear that as well.
I'm just explaining how we can eat all that chocolate cake.
Well, exactly, but I want to get to the chocolate cake here and how much you're eating and exactly how much is rotten in the state of Denmark. And give us some broad numbers. What is the shape and size of taxation in Denmark?
Well, the total tax burden is roughly 48-49%. That's among the highest in the world, depending on how you measure it. The OECD has France just getting just ahead of us, but they also have tax riots now, don't they? So we have a very high tax burden. We also have a tax system that is relatively, if you want to have this higher tax burden, you probably couldn't have it with a really insane tax system. We have a relatively good tax system with a
simple, you mean?
Relatively simple, relatively broad tax base. We tend to lower some of the taxes that are really distortionary. So we have, for instance, our corporate tax rate is not that high. It's higher than Britain's, which is bad. I think Great Britain has gone down because that's going to push us down as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a corporate tax rate of, I think, 22% now, and you'll be moving to 17%?
Well, we're moving 17%. It might go lower than that, depending on who the next Prime Minister is. So in roundabout terms, the total proportion of national income collected is just shy of 50%.
Yes.
So that compares to, in the UK, I think just shy of 40%.
Yeah,
so
that's a huge difference.
That is a major difference. And what about the quality of public services that you get for that? Because, I caricature it here, but the sort of IA free market line here would be for us to say that 38% is already too high. And it doesn't provide particularly efficient services, that actually our education system isn't particularly great for the amount of money we spend on it. Our healthcare system isn't particularly great for the amount of public money spent on it. Our transport system isn't particularly great for the amount of public money spent on it. Are you getting value for money for your 48%? I mean, in Denmark, more than we're getting value for money for our 38% here in Britain, do you think?
No, I don't think we are, but it's very hard to measure those things. But you know, if you look at something like how well educated are Danes, they're quite well educated. For instance, Danish municipalities spent quite different amounts of money per pupil in primary schooling. Mm-hmm. And if you study that and say, okay, the ones that spend a lot of money, are they achieving better results? They're not.
So why isn't there pressure to bring it down, to sort of say, well, you know, you've already said Denmark, very free society, very liberal society, but with the possible exception of France, the sort of highest tax burden in the West, near as damn it, as a proportion of GDP. Why aren't Danes up in arms saying this is absurd? We need to get our taxes down to nearer 30% of GDP because look at all the money that's being wasted.
Danes, generally speaking, think that they are getting a good bargain themselves from the system. I think, whereas many Americans think that they are better off than most people in their country, most Danes think they're worse off than most people in their country. Mm-hmm. So they imagine that it would be a bad deal for themselves if taxes were cut and spending was cut as well. They think that it would result in worse services for themselves.
Do you know the balance between the actual balance between net contributors and net beneficiaries in Denmark to the tax and benefit system, or is that a hard metric to calculate?
It's very hard to calculate. You can do it under certain circumstances, but you need a very broad tax base to get to that level. So it's mm-hmm. not as if sometimes people on the left dream that you can
squeeze it all out of the top 1%.
Exactly, get a lot of extra taxes from the top 1 or top 10%. But the top 1% are already paying 10% of all the taxes. Mm-hmm. So that's 10 times. If everybody was paying the same, it's 10 times that. Mm-hmm. And so that would be equivalent of if you have one child in a school, you're paying for 10. Mm-hmm. And, you know, would it be fair to go much higher? I certainly don't think so. I think you should go somewhat lower. But it's also probably not possible because you get all kinds of effects of people leaving the country or working less. Mm-hmm. So all these effects on incentives and behavior.
Yes, I think it's interesting, those behavioral effects. It's a continual discussion in British policy and threats to the, say, brain drain, as it's called, that, you know, will our highest earners, be they financiers moving to Singapore or New York or professional footballers moving to Madrid or Turin, it's actually a much more complex picture about how behavior changes, isn't it? It's sort of perhaps not striving for your next promotion or perhaps retiring a bit early or spending a bit more time on the golf course and a bit less time in the office.
And we recently had a presentation by a headhunter, and he said that that's part of the problem that he's facing, that sometimes he has people who are really well qualified for a different job where they have more responsibility, but they say, why would I bother? Mm-hmm. So when you reach a certain level, your marginal tax rate in Denmark is 56%. Mm-hmm. So, okay, you're getting a higher pay, but your take home is only, you're only, for every 100 kroner you get extra, it's only 44 mm-hmm. that go to you. And you also have higher expenses, you have more responsibility, you spend less time with the kids, you have less time to do sure. your hobbies. And a lot of people actually react by saying, I'm not interested in that job, I'm not interested in more responsibility.
Yeah, leisure becomes a more preferable commodity to consume than higher income.
It certainly does. And if you look at how much Danes work, we have a relatively high participation rate. A lot of people work.
In the labour market.
In the labour market, mm-hmm. but they work very few hours.
Right, right. Now, there's a bigger picture I wanted to talk to you about, and I'll touch on the specifics shortly because it was particularly a presentation that you made at a recent conference in Athens that caught my eye. But I wanted to hear your views on a wider debate, which I think is happening all over the Western world, in Denmark as much as it is in the UK and across the west of Europe and indeed into North America. And it's I think there are various strands of this that come together. There's concern about income inequality. There's concern about wealth inequality. And there's a concern that those at the bottom can't possibly make it to the top. So that we sort of ossified an ultra elite, maybe a top 1% or a top 0.5%, who keep getting richer come what may. Whereas those who are in the bottom third, in the bottom half, take your pick, are seeing their wages stagnate. They're not seeing their living conditions improve. They're not seeing their wealth being built up. That seems to me a common theme and narrative right across the West. But it also seems to me, when you dig into the numbers, it doesn't appear to be true, or at least not as true as its leading proponents claim. What's your view, before we get into the specific numbers, about, do you agree with me that's been a substantial meme in debate? And what do you think underscores it, if indeed it isn't the statistics?
Yes, I think it's several things. I think one thing is that Denmark is the country I know best, and I think there's probably many different reasons in different countries. But then again, it is something that's happening across countries, so there must be some common denominator to it as well, I guess. I think one of the common denominators is that most OECD countries, to take that group, have been seeing less economic growth over the last 10, 15 years than they used to have. And that means that a lot of focus, when you have good economic growth, people will look around and say, look, everybody else is doing better, but I'm doing better as well, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. And if somebody's doing slightly more better than you are, that's okay.
Sure.
Whereas if you get a sense that I'm not getting ahead the way I used to, you shift your focus a bit towards, well, is somebody else getting what I used to get? And is there some way that I can get more that is not about generating sort of traditional economic growth, but using redistribution? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then it's pretty obvious when you look at the figures that there has actually been a higher income growth in the top 10, top 1% bracket. That's certainly true in most countries. I don't see that as a problem personally, you know, that somebody else is doing better without someone else doing worse. That's sure. A Pareto improvement. Yep. That's a good thing. That's me speaking as an economist. I realize most people aren't economists, but yeah, they should be.
But do you think there's a sense, again, it's very difficult to pin down the precise complaint here in the UK, but about the rich or the hyper affluent, because it tends to just sort of move around dependent on what the particular case under consideration is. But there seems to be a sense, again, it's a nebulous one, that these people haven't earned it properly. I mean, to give you an example, yes. And it might be economists need to look into why this is occurring. If you were to look at the remuneration of chief executives of FTSE 100 companies, well, this seems to be going up and up and up. The ratio between the salary of the top person and the average worker is expanding. Yet it's not obvious that the companies are performing much better. And this leads to a sense, I think, not just of, well, I'm not getting on as well as I used to, but also there are some sort of super billionaires or millionaires over there who seem to be going great guns, despite the fact that you would think that they should be surfing the wave of economic growth that's not occurring. So there seems to be, I think, a building resentment of whether it's the top 1%, the top 5%, or the top 10%, I'm not clear, but a sense that they have not properly earned whatever is actually hitting their pocket.
Yes, I think you're right. And that's always going to be the case, I think, for groups of people who do things that's not very visible. Or is it you have a... The funny thing is you have actors and you have footballers who make even more money than mm-hmm. most top CEOs, you know, mm-hmm. ridiculously higher mm-hmm. amounts than most top CEOs. And I think part of the reason why we accept that is you're a football fan yourself, aren't
sure.
you?
Sure.
Yeah. So when you see...
Although most of my team don't deserve the salary they're getting based on their performance last season.
But the thing is, when you see someone... Name your favorite footballer.
Well, say Nathan Redmond's probably our best player last season.
Okay, so you see Redmond do something on the field, and you know I couldn't do that.
Yeah,
there's no way I could do that. Yep. That is amazing, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he's got all this light on him, and you can see it in slow motion, mm-hmm, and all kinds mm-hmm. of ways in which you can know that he's a brilliant guy. Whereas these top CEOs, the stuff they do, that's behind closed doors.
Sure.
They're in competition with others. It's confidential. And there's no way that we can sort of find out if they are actually as good as they mm-hmm. claim. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it. There is actually research. I don't think we have time to go into it, but Tyler Cowen has just come out with a brilliant new book called Big Business. Mm-hmm. So I can recommend. Do you have show notes for this?
Sure.
Okay, so maybe you can put that in the show notes. I don't get commission. Tyler Cowen goes through some of the economics of this, and he's very, very clear in his conclusion, saying, you know, probably these top CEOs are actually getting less pay than the value they're creating. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So their productivity is higher than the pay they're getting. Yeah. And that's very hard for people to understand. But the one way of thinking about it is, if you're working with two or three other people in a team, you can influence the productivity of those two or three other people positively or negatively.
Sure.
If you're the CEO of a company that has 50,000 employees, you can positively influence the productivity of every one of those people, mm-hmm. or negatively.
What have you found in your research in Denmark about people moving up and down the income ladder? Is it ossified, or is there a lot of turnover?
There's a lot of turnover, and there's, depending on how you look at it, we can't find any sign that there is a slowdown in mobility in Denmark. That's mm-hmm. the country we've been looking at. There's very good data for Denmark. You can follow individuals and how they're doing in terms of income and also all sorts of other things, but we're talking about income now. And we're talking about disposable income. And we can follow that from 1987 up until today. Mm-hmm. And if we do that and take 5-year intervals and look at how much income growth have those who were in the lowest 10% in 1 year, how much income growth have they had over the next 5 years, say? Consistently since 87 up until today, the low income people have had the highest income growth. If you follow them over time.
Because they escape that demographic, or because the poorest decile is actually getting better and better paid? Or because they're escaping up the ladder?
So you can do this in two ways. What I'm doing is I'm following actual people over time.
Right.
And I think that's what we should be interested in. How are actual living people doing?
Yeah.
So it's not that interesting that they start in a low-paying job.
Mm-hmm.
So some people who start in a low-paying job are immigrants. Some are young people without experience. Some are students who have a student job. So there are all kinds of different reasons why you'd have a low-paying job that are not in any way socially problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, most people only have a low-paying job for a very short period of time in Denmark. And they move up into higher income deciles. So decile is a tenth of the population. And if you start in the lowest one, you move up. And a lot of people actually move quite high.
Is that just a feature of age? I mean, it seems to me evident. I mean, maybe I'm just personalizing this to my life, but the, you know, when you enter the labour market, you start at a relatively low wage, you hope it goes up, okay, it ebbs and flows a bit, but you probably expect it to peak at some time in your 40s or 50s, then you retire. Is it just a feature of age, or is something else happening?
It is partly a feature of age. It's a feature of all kinds of things. You know, sometimes when I speak to statisticians or economists about this and show these figures, they say, well, that's just mean reversion. And meaning that if you start at a very low level, there's only one way you can go. And if you start at a very high level, there's only one way you can go. And that is true. But it is not just mean reversion.
It's a term that covers the dynamic. It explains what's actually going on in the economy. It's something that's very significant that's going on there that you use that term for. So you have a dynamic economy where young people have a chance
to move into the labor market, where immigrants have a chance to move in and to improve their skills. And you know, it's not all young people getting older, but even if it was, that would mean that you'd have to be very, very careful when you're looking at, because what is most often done when this is being discussed is you look at what the 10% who earned the least 10 years ago, how much did they earn compared to what the 10% who earned the least this year earn. And then you say, oh, there's been no increase. Well, maybe that's a good thing, because that means that we still have a low level and low entry level job that is available to those with few skills.
And first rung on the ladder concept.
Yeah. Exactly. You don't want a ladder without the first rung, because then you can't get onto the ladder. So the interesting thing is, when you're on the ladder, how long will you be on that first rung before you move up it?
I'm really interested that you say that statisticians have put to you, well, that's just the reversion statistical mean. Because it's not, if we are seeing reversions of the statistical mean, that flies in the face of the popular myth that the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but often that sort of cliche is rolled out. That would be the absolute opposite of a reversion to the mean. So a reversion to the mean does, if that is occurring, seem to be counter to that the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer.
And that is, if we follow people over time, that is certainly not what we're seeing. The rich get poorer over time. So people who are in the top decile, the top 10%, they will, and that is even more true for the top 1%. They will earn, they will have no increase, or and in most years a slight increase in their a decrease in their income over time, whereas the lowest 10% will have over 10 years a significant increase, more than doubling. In our figures, it's 130% increase.
Right,
and that's whichever time period you're looking at. That's the pattern you're getting.
So I'd be interested in your thoughts and approach to social mobility, and in particular, it's because the IEA is running this year an essay competition sponsored by the entrepreneur and businessman Richard Koch, who each year sets an essay question. It's called the Richard Koch Breakthrough Prize, about what policy reforms might be needed in order to achieve a more desirable social outcome. Last year, for example, we focused on the housing market and how it seems to be extremely difficult for those at the bottom to get on the housing market. This year, and I should say entries are now closed, we've had, I think, well over 250 entries, but the challenge was social mobility. And we were particularly looking at what the state might do less of rather than more of to improve social mobility. But it, actually, when we were framing the question, and I haven't read any of the entries yet, and I don't know who the winner will be, we had quite a philosophical argument here at the IEA about what is the optimal level of social and income mobility. Because obviously you could improve income mobility just by sort of randomly confiscating assets from one particular person and giving it to somebody else every 5 minutes. That would actually improve income mobility. Possibly even social mobility. You randomly pluck people out of certain jobs and transfer in people at random to those jobs. How do you approach the issue of social mobility? How desirable is it? I mean, what's the optimal amount? It's clearly above naught, but less than infinite, right?
Well, I used to think that when you look at relative income, I'd be saying, you know, I'm more interested in people leaving the lower brackets than the higher brackets. But I've changed my view on that a little bit. Obviously, you need someone to leave the higher bracket for somebody to mm-hmm. to move into it. I think what we're seeing in Denmark, that people don't stay in high income for a long time. That is a sign that the market is working. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. what competition does. It is very hard to stay up there. Because other people want to get there as well.
Sure.
And they achieve that. And that's why the people who are already there go down. And that's a good thing, to have that mobility.
Yeah, what I was trying to get to, and I appreciate it's impossible to put a figure or a percentage on it.
No,
but how would we look at things and work out whether that's about the right level of turnover, not quite enough, a little bit too much, or whether we've got it bang on right? How would one approach that as a public policy problem?
But I'm not sure I would be looking at it as a policy problem as such. But what I'd be looking at would be what process is leading to this change. I think it's a very different thing to do it with redistribution than mm-hmm, doing it by, for instance, improving education.
Right.
So if you can improve your education system so that some people who used to come out into the labor market
uncompetitive,
missing basic skills like not being good readers and, mm-hmm. and things, and suddenly you get to a situation where you don't have 15% who don't have those skills, but it's 10 or 5%. I mean, that's an enormous improvement for everyone.
Sure.
Whereas if you do it by taking money from people who've earned their own money and giving it to someone else.
Taking it from the readers and giving it to the non-readers.
Yeah, exactly.
You haven't necessarily solved the problem.
You haven't solved the problem, and you've also created some very strong disincentives in the economy, and also from a sort of moral issue, you've taken money from some people who are capable of taking care of themselves and given it to other people who are capable of taking care of themselves. They're just not as good at it.
You mentioned earlier on that actually the state of the public finances in Denmark are pretty stable. I mean, you might be taxing a lot, you might be spending a lot, but you're not running up colossal debts or unfunded liabilities.
No,
is it a concern that you might start doing so?
Well, it's always a concern, but it's not a big concern, because all these political parties, except from the minor extreme ones, certainly the Social Democrats, accept the sort of basic idea that in order to spend an extra Danish kroner, you need to earn it. So they look into the future and say what is available to mm-hmm. spend, and that there is actually money available, and that's what they'll be spending. Whereas we would recommend them to give that back to the citizens as tax mm-hmm. cuts, but that's not what they're choosing to do. And the former government couldn't get around to doing it. They left all this money for them.
Our aim is to sort of try and change the sort of climate of opinion over maybe a 10 or 15 year period, rather than specifically dealing with one piece of legislation today. Are you much more involved in the sort of what I sometimes call policy engineering, the exact legislative process, or are you trying to sort of map out a different policy agenda for Denmark over half a generation or a generation?
The long term is more important to us, but we don't, I mean, if a certain policy debate suddenly appears and is there and we can see that legislation is going to be introduced, we do try, if we have relevant input, we do try to
engage,
influence that as well. But we're less interested in shifting something a little bit in an agenda that's already been set and is a wrong agenda. We're much more interested in trying to set the agenda.
And shift the paradigm.
And shift the paradigm. That's right.
I'm just going to finish on asking you about Denmark's position in the European Union. The debate about the protracted Brexit process for the UK continues to dominate nearly all policy debate here. It's become a bit tedious, really. It's crowded out anything else. It's obviously a massive, important constitutional issue, but has left limited time to discuss other policy areas. What's the view from Denmark on what's happening with regard to Brexit? And how do you see Danes reacting to that, particularly given that historically, at least, Danes have been amongst the more Eurosceptic electorates within the European Union, just like the United Kingdoms?
Well, first of all, few people in Denmark
care.
I wouldn't say that. Few people applaud Brexit because
few applaud it.
Yeah, because you are our ally in the European Union. We have very similar ideas about the world and politics and the European Union. So it's a big. Denmark entered the European Union with Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Entered because of Britain back in 1973, but I don't think we're going to leave because of Britain. At least not in the short run. Currently, the Danes are at the Danish support for the European Union is at the highest level it's ever been, I think.
Membership.
Certainly close to it. Right. And I think that's because people are looking at what's going on in Britain and thinking, well, this looks chaotic. Let's not try that. And it's probably also because of Trump and Putin and stuff like that. A small country would orient themselves towards something that looks a little bit safe and predictable and say, well, it's good to be part of this. On the other hand, I think it's very open what might happen in the long run. I personally would have wished you voted to stay. And I know we two disagree about that. I also salute you for the courage, because you're doing a favor to everyone. It could cost you dearly, but if you manage to do it well, you've shown that there's another way. And I think that is very, very valuable.
But you're a bit worried that could be as expensive and forlorn as being an example on the world stage with green emissions, right? That you could actually end up it being extraordinarily expensive and sending a message, but not actually being beneficial to the wealth of the nation.
I love Britain. I've lived here. I want things to go well for Britain. I hope that you will manage to. I think it's more about the decisions you decide to take when you've closed the door, and which steps do you take from there?
Mm-hmm.
Will you cut taxes? Get rid of red tape? Will you increase private initiative? Personal responsibility. I'm not certain you'll do that. If you do that, you can do well outside the union, I'm sure. I can't remember who it was said. There are two scenarios here. It could be Singapore in the North Sea or Venezuela in the North Sea. I think the risk of Venezuela is not worth taking, because you're doing well inside the union. Now you will do it, and I really, really hope that you manage to take the decisions necessary to make this work for Britain.
Well, Martin, you've ended superbly there with sketching out the reform agenda challenge, not just for the United Kingdom, but for the IEA specifically, to make sure that we have the right sound economic thinking, however Brexit ends up. Martin, it's been a pleasure to have you here with us for this podcast, live from 2 Lord North Street. Great to have you back in London, and we wish you every success with your endeavours with CPOS back in Copenhagen. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. It's been an honour. I'm a big fan of the Institute of Economic Affairs.
Thanks a lot.